The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is the size of Connecticut. Nitrate levels hit record highs in Iowa rivers this year. But those problems are not new. There are some controversial new policies in place to address them. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about water quality issues in Iowa and the nutrient reduction strategy, a set of voluntary regulations put into place to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from Iowa's farms. I'll talk with Iowa Public Radio reporter Clay Masters. I'll talk with Bill Stowe, CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works, Bill Northey, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, and ISU economist John Lawrence. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The news of a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico the size of the state of Connecticut and high levels of nitrates threatening the drinking water of Iowa's largest city. That news is scary, but this problem is far from new in our state. This hour, we're going to talk about water quality issues in Iowa and the nutrient reduction strategy, a new set of voluntary regulations put into place to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from Iowa's farms. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Bill Stowe, CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works, Bill Northey, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, and also John Lawrence, an economist from Iowa State University. But we're going to start the hour with Iowa Public Radio reporter Clay Masters, who's been reporting on this issue. Good morning, Clay.
Good morning, Charity.
Let's start with the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. This is something we've been hearing about since the size started to be recorded in 1985. But in a nutshell, tell me what this problem is.
Well, basically, it's the nitrate runoff from farms, and you know, it's not just farms. That's what I focused on in the piece that you might have heard in Morning Edition. There are concerns about what point polluters are putting out there. There is some regulation over how much they can emit, but basically, all this is flowing downstream and winding up in the Gulf of Mexico.
So a point polluter would be like a factory or something, an organization specifically that has issues with polluting the environment. Non-point polluters are the agricultural producers that we're talking about.
That's right.
And how much of a contribution does Iowa make to this dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico?
Well, I can't talk specifically to Iowa, and I'm hoping other people can. In this report that I worked on, I've been hearing about the dead zone for years, and you know, this nutrient reduction strategy was unveiled last fall, I believe it was. The governor and the secretary of agriculture and ISU's John Lawrence, who we'll hear from in a moment. And you know, they're just words that are being, you know, said at a press conference, and then it came out. And you know, I wanted to spend the time actually traveling, you know, along the river. I went down to the southeast corner of the state and moved my way north up to Des Moines, and to try to just get a perspective from the different players and people that are policymakers or farmers about the contributions that they're making and ways to deal with it.
And of course, it's not just about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, because if all of this nitrogen is traveling to the Gulf, it's also present in the water in Iowa as well.
Yeah, certainly. And Bill Stowe can talk about that with Des Moines Water Works in a little bit. But yeah, there are these environmental concerns that are going on. And I talked to a number of farmers all three of the farmers that are mentioned in the piece that you can hear at iowapublicradio.org are doing conservation practices to cut back on the runoff that they're contributing. And it is a large amount of that contribution to the dead zone and to the high nitrate levels in the Des Moines and Raccoon River that supply the drinking water for Des Moines are coming from farms.
And the news that we were hearing this year, and we'll get more into the details of it in a moment, but some people have been putting it down to a sort of a freak weather situation. Last summer, we had this intense drought, which caused a lot of the nutrients that had been put on farm fields to not be taken up by plants. And then we had floods this spring.
Right. And so that, you know, made it top of mind, and it became, you know, more of an issue because oh my gosh, there's, you know, higher nitrate levels, and the denitrification system at the Des Moines Water Works was being put into place. Certainly Bill Stowe can speak to this later, that, you know, it cost a lot to take those nitrates out of the water. And so you really heard a lot about it this summer because, one, of the weather pattern that we've had, and two, because this nutrient reduction strategy was unveiled. And that was a call from the Environmental Protection Agency for states to do something about it. And Iowa was one of the first.
And we will dig more into the details of the nutrient reduction strategy and where it comes from in a few minutes. But can you give me an idea of where some of the controversy about this strategy comes from? This is a voluntary nutrient reduction strategy, right?
Yeah, and that's really where the debate is full force, in that should there be a polluter pay system in place? And regulating that is what a lot of times comes into question of how do you do that when there's such a large amount of farms? So that's how you regulate non-point polluters is what the big sticking point is right now.
All right. And the regulations for point polluters, as we pointed out the difference earlier, those regulations are very different.
Right, right. And certainly I don't want to take away from what our experts have to say on that.
Okay. All right. Well, let me bring Bill Stowe into the conversation first. He is CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Cherry.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure. You're welcome.
And describe for me, we've heard reports on the radio, seen reports in the newspaper about the high nitrate levels in the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers this year. There have been record high nitrate levels in other rivers in the state as well. But can you describe for me what happened this spring?
Well, what happened is we saw in Des Moines, where we're near the confluence of both the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers, we saw high levels not only on each river individually, but both of them record levels at the same time. And for us, that's very alarming because we're able in our technology to move our source water collection from one river to another when we experience a particular problem. And it's not unusual for us to see high nitrate levels on either the Des Moines or Raccoon River. But when they're both record highs at the same time, that creates significant concerns for us.
And what are those concerns? What are the dangers?
Well, the dangers are that we would be in noncompliance with federal safe drinking water limits on nitrate levels in drinking water. The source water, the raw water that we take when it's so heavily polluted with nitrates, creates significant difficulties for us to denitrify, to remove the nitrates. In Des Moines, we have a world-class, arguably one of the largest denitrification facilities in the world that regulation forced us to construct at significant cost 20 years ago to denitrify, but it has its limits. We can only denitrify water quickly enough. The population in this area and the number of customers that we serve has significantly grown in the last 20 years, and we hope it'll continue to grow in the next 20. But that creates a real constraint for us that creates economic concerns. And ultimately, what we're really concerned about is it shakes the confidence of our consumers and our customers in safe drinking water.
It also is an enormous expense for you.
Very much so. This last event, about 79 or 80 days where either the Des Moines or Raccoon were above from a source water level federal drinking water standards. We spent $900,000 in trying to denitrify and in one situation really had to discourage and move one of our wholesale customers to another source other than our own water. So very expensive for our ratepayers. And again, a concern that we would have from an economic development standpoint is that we are raising red flags to businesses who may want to relocate or residents who may want to relocate to this area of Iowa that our water supply isn't reliable. And that's clearly something that troubles us above and beyond the immediate concern of trying to make sure every day we're delivering safe drinking water.
From your perspective and from your research, what caused the spike this year?
Well, and it's pretty clear. We'll be talking, I'm sure, in some detail about the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, a document that we find very sound in its science, very clear that in looking through that and looking at the scientific conclusions that the attribution of 90% of pollutant sources to ag uses and 10% to others, including cities, it really indicates the disparity there. It's an ag source. It's a chemical ag source that's coming down to us through 10,000 square miles of farmland above us in the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers.
All right. Now I want to bring Bill Northey into the conversation, Iowa's Secretary of Agriculture. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Charity.
And also John Lawrence, Associate Dean in the Department of Economics at Iowa State University. Hello, John.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Secretary Northey, let me start with you. We are talking about this nutrient reduction strategy this hour. Can you lay it out for us? Describe what the new recommendations are that were unveiled last fall.
Well, I think it's important to figure out what does it take to have an impact on reducing the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that leaves our farms. And so what came about was a couple of years ago we sat down, John Lawrence was part of the conversation, we said what, you know, as opposed to figuring out regulation or what the changes are from year to year, we want to figure out practices that work every year that could be adopted by farmers and figure out how much of a savings from the loss of nitrogen from our farms those practices would entail. So Iowa State went through and looked at the research, and we said, okay, cover crops can create 30 to 35% reduction, other practices moving from a fall application to a spring application might be a 5% reduction in the loss of nitrogen. And looking at all those practices and then figuring out what it's going to take to encourage folks to use those. Now, nitrogen and phosphorus act very different. Both of them can have an impact on the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. We have lakes in Iowa that are more concerned about phosphorus. We have rivers where we're more concerned about nitrogen. And they're different, coming from different parts of the landscape. So we need to target those into the areas where they can make a difference. And what the strategy did was put that science together and then figure out ways to encourage farmers, to show them the science, to develop more science as time goes on as well, and how we can use those practices to make a difference. Again, I think there's, certainly as we talk about strategies, all of us want to find ways to do better things. And if there's the ways that are going to be better things are practices on the farms that work both in dry years like last year, but in wet years like this year. And if we can develop more of those, encourage more, then we have a great chance at having a real impact on the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that are in our lakes or in our rivers.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to this conversation in just a moment. I'm talking with Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey, Iowa State University economist John Lawrence, also, Bill Stowe, CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works, and also with us today, Iowa Public Radio reporter Clay Masters. We're talking about water quality in Iowa and the nutrient reduction strategy that has been put into place to try to reduce pollution from Iowa's farmers. You're welcome to join this conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about water quality in Iowa, which is an issue that has been in the news a lot recently. With a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, it was projected to be at record levels this year. It didn't quite make it, but it's still the size of Connecticut. We also did have record high levels of nitrates in the Des Moines River, in the Raccoon River, and also in the Cedar River. And last fall, a new nutrient reduction strategy was unveiled by the state of Iowa to encourage farmers to reduce the amount of nutrient runoff from their fields. And again, this is a set of voluntary regulations that were put into place. With me today, I have Bill Northey, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, ISU economist John Lawrence, Bill Stowe, CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works, and also Iowa Public Radio reporter Clay Masters, who has been reporting on this issue. And John, I want to go to you. We just heard from Secretary Northey talking about putting this new reduction strategy into place. You were involved in developing the strategy. Can you give me a little bit of insight on the process and the decision to make this a voluntary strategy?
we took was to, oftentimes as we look at these things, we say, let's start with sound science. And so we invested heavily in making sure we understood the science, what contributions were coming from the different sources, like agriculture versus point source, and then what practices have been proven through research to effectively address the loss of nitrogen and phosphorus into our waters. We had a team of over 20 scientists, most of them from here at Iowa State, but they included the USDA Agricultural Research Service. We had scientists from Iowa DNR, from Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship. We had a couple from other states that contributed some. And when we were done with this, we put the findings out for peer review, much like we would any research product. And what it did is help us identify a rather short list of practices that have been proven to be effective. The other thing it showed was that although effective, they're highly variable, largely dependent on weather conditions, soil conditions, and other things. And so we need to continue to work to find not only new practices, the next generation, if you will, of these innovations, but also how do we improve the confidence and the predictability of these practices moving forward. We've been working, as Secretary Northey said, for a couple of years to inform farmers about the need to improve our adoption of these practices. We've been working with field days, partnering with agencies, developing fact sheets and materials to help get the word out to get more people tuned into this. It's something that we think will take time to get people to adopt new practices. They may have to buy new equipment. They'll want to experiment and sample some of these or see how their neighbors get along with it. But ultimately, those are the types of changes that have to occur on the in the fields before we see an effect in the water.
Now, we report on strategies that farmers can use to reduce nutrient runoff, to reduce soil erosion. We report on that all the time. What's new in this nutrient reduction strategy beyond all of the recommendations that farmers have been hearing for years?
I think what's different about this is the I would almost say, a laser-type focus. The Gulf Hypoxia Task Force came out with a recommendation to reduce the loss of N and P by 45% from the state of Iowa. Much of what we've heard in practices before is this is a good idea, you ought to do it, and so on. This made us stop and really say, how many acres of a particular practice would it take to achieve that goal?
And when do we hope to achieve that goal by?
And as soon as people can adopt these practices on an ongoing basis, that they have make those changes in their operation.
We don't really have a timeline.
We don't. You can talk to Secretary Northey about that. The policy team that worked on that addressed that decision and decided that it's best to get started rather than, I think, focusing on when the finish line is.
We have an email from Cindy in Story County, and Secretary Northey, this gets to that question. She says, living between an impaired river and an impaired lake, I attended the Ames meeting on the nutrient strategy where we were told that there wasn't funding for any large new incentives, with only small incentives and with no penalties, numerical standards, or timetables. Why should we believe the strategy will work any better than the existing voluntary farm pollution policy that has, in her words, failed to protect water for many years?
Well, the legislature did step forward this last year and provide some new funding. And in fact, just over the last 2.5 weeks here, we've put out for application an opportunity for folks to be able to cost share cover crops, strip-till, no-till, nitrification inhibitors. All came out of that study as practices that can be beneficial. They don't work for everybody. They don't work in every landscape. But we put those practices out for cost share. In this case, the farmer will pay about half the cost of those. State government will pay half the cost or less of that. We put $2.8 million out for cost share. We'll now have about 109,000 acres of new cover crops this fall that on farmers that have never tried cover crops before. that we think not only will they in some cases have more cover crops than that, that they will put in on their own dime completely, but we think in the future those folks will have increased number of cover crops as well. So I think we're seeing a lot of momentum. Nearly 1,100 farmers came forward with the contribution that they're going to make to apply for that cost share. We have some other programs, and we have a lot of folks that are doing it on their own as well. So I think there's a real momentum to adopt practices that do work. These practices are not all easy and new. From the outside, it looks like you can snap your finger and have cover crops all work. There are lots of different ways of putting these cover crops on, different seeding methods, being able to kill them off in next spring in time to get the benefit for the nitrogen and phosphorus savings that you want to have, but not hurt your yields the following year as well. And so there's a lot of learning process that has to go into this, including some farmers can make it work into their system of management easier than other farmers. But I am very confident we're seeing a good amount of momentum. We see a lot of interest in these practices, and I think Iowa has stepped forward to do things that other places have not stepped forward to do. I think the other question that's begged by the conversation that we've had here as well is we looked at voluntary versus mandatory. And mandatory isn't just a matter of there's too many farmers to put regulations on. It's where do you go? How do you do that? Who do you tell to do what where? And when we say non-point is a descriptor of farm practices, but it's also because you have no point to go and say this person is a significant contributor to the nitrogen in the Raccoon River. Just as we talk non-point urban, we can't say that that golf course has XYZ contribution and therefore needs to pay a penalty or can't use any more fertilizer or your backyard can't get any more fertilizer. Non-point is inherently harder to figure out how to manage, and certainly, you know, has not been looked at generally for a regulatory framework where point sources you can. You can go to the end of the pipe. You can say what's happening here. You can see a consistent movement. Boy, the movement off a farm is very different in the May that we just had with record amounts of rainfall versus the August that we're having with very, very dry rainfall. So inherently, the struggles of trying to compare regulation from a point source versus a non-point source needs to be looked at different, and it's not the same thing. Besides the fact you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of farms, tens of thousands of farmers, you're dealing with a handful of point sources. So there's a lot of reasons why I believe the most effective way at making improvements is through a voluntary system where we get farmers to do things that work on their farms. We help them adopt these practices. And I believe that's the way that sticks, as opposed to trying to run enough government regulators out there to check over every farm and make sure that they're doing the right thing in each of the farms that look different in different places when we can't even figure out the amount that they're contributing.
I want to turn back to Clay Masters. Clay, as you began to explore this issue and talk to farmers and policymakers around the state, what did you learn?
Well, the biggest takeaway for me, this spanned a couple months. So, you know, while there was various things going on in the state, there was a Environment Iowa had a little rally in front of the state where they handed signatures to the Senate chair of the Natural Resources Committee. Gina McCarthy, the new EPA administrator chief, was at the Iowa State Fair. All these things are going on. I was going out on day trips and talking with various people. And the one thing that was a commonality with everyone I talked to was that everyone agrees that this needs to be cut down on. But how you get there is what really is being debated. And I thought that the best kind of representation of some kind of middle ground here was, you know, there was, for people that haven't heard the piece, there was a farmer I talked to in Eagle Grove, which is north of Ames, north central Iowa. He's got about 800 acres. His name's Tim Smith. And, you know, he kind of likens back to you know, farming years ago when it was a little smaller, 800 acres. And you know, he is a part of the Mississippi River Basin Healthy Watership Initiative, or Watershed, excuse me, Initiative. And he had said for years, the 35 years he'd been farming, he never thought he was a part of the problem. And then he got his nitrate levels checked, and he was amazed that they were the same amount as the river that he was sending down there. And that really opened his eyes. And I think that there's a lot of farmers out there that just, they might not even know. And
you know, we have some tape from your interview with Tim Smith. And again, he's a farmer outside of Eagle Grove. Let's listen to what he has to say.
Great.
There's a clash between what agriculture is doing and what urban people expect. And I think farmers need to realize we're in the minority. When my great-granduncle bought this farm, about 50% of the population was farmers. Today it's less than 2%. And, you know, that we have to protect critical resources, the soil and the water. And it's the strategy is an excellent thing to follow. I didn't realize when I first signed up with the MRBI program that I would be doing the Iowa Nutrient Management Strategy a couple years ahead of time. And when it first came out last winter, I started reading through it, and I said, well, I'm doing that. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. And I guess as this list also shows the expected reductions in nitrates losses, and based on my data that I've collected the last couple of years from my own farm, I would say they're realistic, very realistic, but farmers need to do them. I was of the opinion before I started all this, I wasn't part of the problem. I often ask myself, I wonder where the nitrates are coming from, because I put my nitrogen on in a best management practices. I waited till the soil temperatures were below 50 degrees. Sometimes I waited till I was probably the last. If I fall applied my nitrogen, I was one of the last people to put it on in the fall. I waited till it really got cold. But when I saw the results my first year in 2011 and realized I was at the top of what the stream was, I said, something's wrong here. So that really opened my eyes to what was going on and realizing I was part of the problem, even though I was doing what I thought was, you know, the best I could do.
That's Tim Smith, a farmer who maintains 800 acres outside of Eagle Grove. And Clay, for him, he had that epiphany, but I would guess that a lot of farmers in Iowa, of course, there are all different kinds of farmers in the state of Iowa. A lot of farmers probably still don't have an understanding of what part they play in this.
Yeah, I think that there's truth in that. And, you know, even when you, one of the problems I had too was just when you talk about the amount of farms that are in Iowa, you know, there was a figure recently that 700 farms had signed up to participate in the nutrient reduction strategy. Well, Tim Smith, the farm that the governor and Secretary Northey toured in Winterset, they both had been doing these practices for years. And so, you know, it's hard to even, for me as a reporter, to even quantify how much of this is being done already for me to understand how effective it's been. And I think that's really at the core of the conversation. And certainly Secretary Northey could probably speak to the amount of farms that are here and how you kind of put your finger on how many there are.
Well, I want to get to the phones before we get to that question with Secretary Northey. Bruce is on the line from Paulina at 866-780-9100. Hello, Bruce.
Hello, Charity.
Hi there. And you are a farmer, right?
Yes. I'm a farmer here in Northwest Iowa, third generation, and my son is the fourth, and my daughter is joining the operation next week. So, yeah, we're farming.
Give me a little bit of your perspective.
Well, I think the thing that needs to be understood is that for the most part, farmers are not out here to soil our bed. We really do want to do it right. But as your previous segment was saying, you sometimes don't realize that maybe what you're doing isn't quite there yet. My family, my grandfather was born in 1870. He actually did homesteading in Minnesota, bought the farm that I'm on in 1905. My father brought back contouring in the 1950s. I changed operation to ridge till. We have gone to utilizing hog manure as fertility. So we've gone more from ridge till into minimum no-till type things. My son has encouraged us to go to 15-inch row corn so as to get a canopy to protect the soils that much quicker. These are conservation moves we've made as a family without this type thing. This is the way we look at things. We're trying to improve things. We have to remember that we have absolutely wonderful soils here in Iowa, being so nutrient-rich naturally and with the high organic matter. And so as that decomposes and moves, this is where I think also you see the variability in the nutrient load is just because of the flexibility of weather.
Bruce, you know, unfortunately, we need to take a short break here. We'll get back to this conversation in a moment. Bruce, thank you so much for sharing your perspective today. Today, we're talking about water quality in Iowa and the nutrient reduction strategy, which is a set of voluntary regulations put into place to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from Iowa's farms. With me today, Bill Stowe, CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works, Bill Northey, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, and ISU economist John Lawrence, also IPR reporter Clay Masters. We'll be back in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about water quality issues in Iowa and the nutrient reduction strategy that was unveiled by the state last fall, a set of voluntary regulations put into place to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from Iowa's farms. With me this hour, I have Bill Northey, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, ISU economist John Lawrence, who was involved in creating this reduction strategy, also IPR reporter Clay Masters, and Bill Stowe, CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works. And Bill Stowe, I want to get back to you. You, of course, have been watching very closely the kind of water quality in your part of the state of Iowa. Can you give us sort of a long-term picture of how you've seen things change over the last 15 or 20 years?
Charity, we're data-rich in my business because we're very interested in water quality metrics on both the Des Moines and Raccoon River. To summarize, the trend is increasingly of concern for us. The water in both the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers, and we, in our view, continues to degrade. We see nitrate levels stretching back from the 30s till now that even setting aside this episodic incident we've just gone through that some folks say is drought-related, the waters of the state continue to degrade. And that's a huge concern for us because there's been a lot of discussion about voluntary versus involuntary. And ultimately for us, it's a public health issue. Safe drinking water is critical to you and me on a daily basis, on a minute-to-minute basis, and the idea of undefined time frames and discussing better conservation practices really does not deal with the real data that we think the rivers continue to degrade and really the success that we've seen as a country in environmental regulation. Regulation, we think, sounds so negative whenever we talk about it by the folks on the other side of this issue, but regulation brings us safe medicine and air traffic control and speed limits, all pretty important to promote national and local values. And we think water deserves that kind of attention and not attention on vague timelines and that really talk about the romance of family farms. That isn't what we're talking about. We have a lot of respect for the ag economy in Iowa, but we have a fundamental responsibility to provide safe and affordable drinking water, and ag is certainly getting in the way of that right now.
When I talk to farmers around the state, as I mentioned earlier, there are all kinds of different kinds of farmers. And in Clay's piece, we certainly heard from farmers who had decided that they wanted to put in conservation practices on their own farms. But I've also talked to farmers who have taken out some of their timber so they can plant more corn. I've talked to farmers who have planted corn in their fields for 20 years in a row because BT corn made it possible for them to do that. And those are some of the practices where we see more nutrient runoff. But with what seems to be an increasing interest in conservation practices and new developments in conservation practices in Iowa. Bill, you haven't seen any kind of an improvement on the basis of some of those changes?
We really have not. We've seen quite the opposite. Again, we have seen record levels in the last few months of nitrates in both the Des Moines and Raccoon. Just to give you a sense of how we view some of the numbers that Secretary Northey's used, he talked about roughly 110,000 acres that have been moved to cover crops. The amount of land tilled in Iowa, I think, is on the magnitude of 25 million acres. So these kind of incremental changes certainly are ones that are in a positive direction, but they're at such a slow pace that they're just not inclined to lead to real results. And what we're looking for is a move beyond talk about beyond voluntarism to a fundamental understanding that the waters of the state are part of the commonwealth of the state and need to be protected, and not protected through voluntary actions only, but protected at a far higher level.
John Lawrence, as you were involved in putting together these recommendations, we are talking about voluntary strategies for farmers to take part in. We're talking about some cost sharing from the state of Iowa. But what's really in it for the farmer? What are the incentives?
Well, it varies with practice. There are some practices that identify it, like following the university recommendations on the amount to apply would be a cost savings from not applying more than the recommended amount. There is some trade-off in, say, fall versus spring that our research would show there may be some savings to spring-applied nitrogen. You'd think, well, why aren't farmers doing that? It's perhaps because us as researchers don't fully appreciate the value of time. The farmer's time in the spring may be more valuable than it is after harvest in the fall. And so there's those types of things come into play. The other thing is that farmers, many of them own that land, or somebody clearly does, a landlord that they may be renting from. It's their largest investment, typically, and with current land prices, it's quite high. And so certainly from a soil erosion and protection of their own property, they have some incentives. The challenge is sometimes on the nitrogen side, because it doesn't stay with that land, they have the immediate value of perhaps some nutrient savings. So how do you incentivize them to protect what leaves their property? And that's where we see through water districts, drainage management systems that are going together to put in wetlands to help remove nitrogen before the water goes downstream. So they put in buffers to remove nitrogen. So there are some things that they can benefit from directly. Some, it does have to go back to what's their view of their responsibility.
I want to get back to the phones now. Sherry's on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Sherry.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I guess my concern is that, you know, when I hear Bill Northey and others say that he wants to encourage farmers to follow best practices, this is really code for voluntary compliance that really got us into this mess to begin with. And, you know, I'm a ratepayer. I've lived here in Des Moines for a long time, and now 500,000 people are being asked to pay for the pollution coming downstream. So I guess my question is, how is it that continued voluntary compliance is going to change the fact that pollution is still continuing? And, you know, some of the best practices have been out there for a long time. Cover crops is not new. Farmers have voluntarily decided not to do that. No-till is not new. Farmers have voluntarily decided not to do that. So in terms of voluntary compliance, how can that possibly change the landscape and what is coming down to me and 500,000 other ratepayers?
Sherry, thanks a lot for your call. And of course, we've been trying to get to that question. Secretary Northey, can you briefly respond to Sherry?
It can. Certainly, I understand the concern that these practices are being increasingly adopted. Certainly, NRCS just came out with some studies to look at that the decrease in the contribution of nitrogen and phosphorus to the Gulf of Mexico has been substantial. There's a 21% reduction in the amount of nitrogen, 52% reduction in the amount of phosphorus. It's because of erosion control practices, timing of nitrogen applications, increased use of cover crops. Frankly, some of the ways of being able to do these things are actually new. We're flying more of the cover crop seed on in a standing crop in north central Iowa, and my farm is up in Dickinson County. My plan is to be able to have that flown on this fall. It wouldn't have time enough to grow if I drilled it after I planted that crop. So there are practices, there are methods here that are new. We believe we can share that information. We're seeing increasing adoption of those practices. No-till has come about in a large part across the state because of voluntary adoption. And just the weaknesses or the challenges there of trying to make sure that people understand how these practices can work in their operations also begs the question, what's the alternative?
Well,
what does regulation look like? Do we tell farmers that everybody has to no-till, everybody has to cover crop in all places when we know that's not right for every operation and we don't have enough people to go around and chase down every situation out there? So it's not just it's not as good as. I believe, is the best way to get adoption. I believe there are super weaknesses in trying to look at a mandatory regulatory approach.
John, I want to ask you, because you mentioned in the piece that Clay had on the air this morning, you said, you know, if we have this conversation in 5 years, it could be a very different kind of conversation, with the intimation that time may be running out. Well, we've been talking about no-till practices for a very long time. We've been talking about the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. It's been being measured since 1985, and pretty much it just keeps growing. So when is it too late? When do we have to take a different kind of action?
Well, as Secretary Northey mentioned earlier, the legislature stepped up and put additional resources in. Now that we have the strategy, which is a game plan, as opposed to saying go out and do good things, we're fairly specific about what that list looks like. There was additional resources to help make that happen. The message has been clearly sent to agriculture that we need to not only do these practices, but document these practices, and you know, results have to occur. Whether that time frame is 5 years or something else, I'm not sure. We focused in on what are the practices that make a difference. How do you get those applied on the land is going to be up to our farmers. And ultimately, if the farmers don't, you know, step up and do their part, it will go back to the policymakers.
And Clay, a lot of people who have problems with this nutrient reduction strategy, of course, we've talked about the fact that it's voluntary, but also that lack of a timeline seems to be something that really frustrates people.
Yeah, and, you know, this is something that takes time for farmers to see how it is cutting down. You know, I talked about Tim Smith. We listened to some of what he had to say up in Eagle Grove. It's something that they have to watch and they have to monitor. And in my conversation with EPA Region 7, District 7 Administrator Carl Brooks, you know, he said this is a living document and that this is something that might need to be revisited at some point and that people will make these changes. So it's hard to, you know, from a reporter's standpoint, it's hard to really put your finger on, you know, what it's going to take when there's so many different ways of measuring farms and so many different ways of putting these practices in place, which, you know, why we have these experts on our show today.
And there has been legal action taken against this strategy in Iowa, correct?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. There's been a lawsuit threatened against this strategy.
I believe so.
Okay. But there are groups that are trying to do something to change this policy initiative. I want to turn back to you, Bill Stowe. We have a question for you from someone who sent us an email. They want to know what's being done with the nitrates after they're being removed from the rivers in Des Moines.
The easy answer to that question is under our permit, under our regulation, we're allowed to re-release it into the Raccoon River. we're investigating alternatives to that because that clearly creates concerns for us. But under the regulations that we operate under, we're allowed to re-release it into the river and do that.
So this pollution is going back into the water?
For the most part, that's absolutely the case.
All right. We are nearly out of time. I want to take a look forward from this point because, as we've talked about, these problems are not new. And there have been a lot of different conservation practices that have been developed, researched, and proposed for farmers in Iowa and elsewhere in the Midwest over the years. Of course, many of those practices come from Iowa State University. So, John, can you give me a look forward? Again, I want to refer to what you said in Clay's piece about maybe in 5 years this will be a very different kind of conversation. What do you see happening in the future, and when does the conversation change?
Well, I think that the near term is working on the strategy we have in hand. How do we not only get farmer adoption of these practices, but document that is happening, or in fact, document that maybe it's not happening. But as was mentioned earlier, just trying to know exactly what practices are in place and where is a challenge in itself. So I think that's the first step. I think that the legislature also funded a Iowa Nutrient Research Center that's a Regents Center, involves University of Iowa, Northern Iowa, as well as Iowa State, to look at new innovations and practices, but also get at the social science side of things. Why, you know, what are the barriers to adoption? What are the economic incentives or disincentives that farmers face out there regarding these practices, and better understand that to, again, help us get better adoption or better understand what changes are occurring. So I think those are important first steps, is finding out more once we have a very defined list of things, understand why we're not seeing the adoption in the past, as people have mentioned, what hurdles may exist going forward. I think even if this does change in a few years, the conversation, those barriers may still exist. And whether you try to regulate it or you try to incentivize it, understanding those will be an important first step.
We have this comment from Dan in Ida Grove, who is a farmer. He says that farmers will watch other farmers adopting new practices until they do the practices themselves. He believes that in 5 years we'll see positive results. Bill Stowe, I know that you have a lot of strong concerns about this. Do you feel like we're on the right track? And when do you think the conversation needs to change?
I'm not sure we even agree on what the track is. Voluntarism has provided very little environmental relief when we look at the history of the United States, air quality issues as an example, and water quality issues. The problem with this point source, non-point source issue is that that's a legal issue. In agriculture, there certainly are pipes. There are drainage tiles. There are culverts. But the way the legislation was drawn up 40 years ago, essentially those are taken off the regulatory scheme. The reality is the nutrient reduction strategy reminds us most of the pollution is coming from those sources, whether we call them point or non-point.
We are out of time, and clearly this is a conversation we will be returning to in the future. Thank you so much to all of my guests today. I talked with Bill Stowe, CEO and General Manager of Des Moines Water Works, Bill Northey, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, ISU economist John Lawrence, and IPR reporter Clay Masters. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.